What does it take to chase fireballs in the sky? Oh, I'm so glad you asked. I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Occam's Razor, a soapbox for science. Today, Ellie Sampson takes us on a meteorite hunt in the outback.
Good evening. Thanks for having me. I would first like to pay my respects to the Whadjuk people of Noongar Nation, our nation's basically first astronomers. So it's lovely to be here. I am Ellie Sampson, and I'm a researcher at Curtin's Space Science and Technology Centre, and I'm a planetary scientist. And it's probably something that not many of you have really heard before. It's a really interesting field that sits kind of halfway between astronomy and geology, where astronomy is looking out beyond and geology is looking at our own planet Earth and trying to understand how it formed and evolved. And nowadays, the technology that we've got and the data that we can acquire and the images that we have of the planets in our own solar system are just so good that we can start to apply those geological techniques to those bodies in our own solar system. So, back here on Earth, I run a program called the Global Fireball Observatory, and we use networks of cameras across Australia and now the world to observe really, really bright shooting stars so that we can recover meteorites. Now, meteorites are super cool bits of space rock that come burning through our atmosphere, and we can use them to study a little bit about our solar system, how it formed and evolved, those early chemistries and those environments, and possibly even where Earth's water came from, and maybe even life itself. So I'm going to ask a question to the audience, if I may. Has anyone here seen a shooting star? I see a raise of hands. There's quite a few out there. Lovely. It is special, right? Especially if you happen to go out at the time of a meteor shower where you might see quite a few. Now, a typical meteor is something that comes by and it's pretty quick, right? It's enough to say, ooh, hey, look, and tap your friend on the shoulder, but they've missed it because they were looking the wrong way. Typical meteors are made of actually really small sand to dust size particles, and they burn up basically almost instantly, but they still come in really, really fast, sometimes up to 72 kilometers per second. That's kilometers per second, so that's 300 times the speed of a bullet, and like going from Perth to Sydney in 45 seconds. Now, I'm sure any of you that have been on that red-eye flight can imagine that, and how cool would that be? But larger objects do still come in, but they're much less common. The Global Fireball Observatory has cameras around Australia and the outback, and now the world with our partners abroad, and we're looking at the skies all night, every night, from dusk till dawn, looking out for these objects. And from those different camera positions, we can do what we call triangulation. It's a little bit like how our eyes can gauge distance, but we can get an idea of that path that the object took as it comes through our atmosphere. And we can model and get an idea of the speeds that they were doing, and then we can get an idea of how big that might have been and if there's any meteorites left to recover on the ground. So what happens if we think a meteorite has survived? Well, those fireballs can sometimes look really close, but a space rock usually stops burning at around 25 kilometres altitude. Most of them do burn up entirely, but those that reach down to about 25 kilometres, there's a good chance there's a rock for us to recover. Now, that's about twice the height of that Perth to Sydney red-eye flight, so the planes are okay from these events, really. But when we're trying to model how they come down to the ground, we have to get an idea of the winds. So how is our little space rock actually getting blown down to the ground under those 25 kilometers of altitude? And we can predict what we call a fall line on the ground with like the bigger stuff on one end and the smaller stuff on the other. And it really kind of depends on what we predict that mass to be. And if that's exploded, there's probably some fragments all the way along there. So at this point, we usually get a team of about six people together and drive out into the middle of nowhere and go for a meteorite hunt, which is pretty awesome. And we set up camp near some trees. If we can find any trees in the area, usually it's just scrubs, but trees are good, and not because of the shade, but selfishly for a bit of privacy when you go for a walk with a shovel in the morning after the morning coffee. And I can tell you after 2 weeks at the same spot, the picking's getting pretty slim. So if we want to actually go out and search for these meteorites, we find where that fall line is, we go and have a scout, we line up basically probably about 200 meters off the line, like a search and rescue attempt. And we walk towards that line, across it, scouting the ground for those burnt little black bits of space rock. And we zigzag our way up. We start where we have a better, we think, the mass, main mass might be, but also looking out for fragments. The contrast that we have with those black rocks and the Australian outback and the red dirt is really good, and it's much better than where these attempts have been done in Europe, where you're trying to traipse through a forest. But there are still black rocks that we call meteorongs that we do have to kind of weed out. The most common meteorong is kangaroo poo, which looks very similar to a fresh meteorite, I can tell you. So we're actually doing really well with this. The Global Fireball Observatory now around the world has around 13 meteorites that we've recovered, and that's actually 25% of the global collection of meteorites that we have associated orbits for. So that's with our single project, we've got 25% of those, so we're really proud of that. We're looking to try and increase that and get more, and a couple of years ago my colleague Seamus Anderson started thinking, well, why don't we just use a drone to survey the area and get a computer to do the hard work with machine learning? Shouldn't be too hard, right? Well, it took him into his entire PhD, but he nailed it. It's awesome. About a year and a half ago, we found our first meteorite in the Nullarbor using his techniques, and at the end of last year, we actually used it to map a really large strewn field in South Australia where something really big exploded in the atmosphere, leaving debris pretty much in a really large area that we would never have gone and searched by foot. It would have just been too epic. So we found 50 meteorites in that area so far, and they are in the South Australian Museum if you ever venture over that way. So we're now covering around 30 million square kilometres of sky across Australia, which is, and across the world, just under 1% of the world's skies. And not all of these are going to drop meteorites. So although we can, the really valuable thing that we're doing with the meteorites is linking them, as I suggested earlier, to their orbital origins. Where did they come from in the solar system? We're trying to piece together the geochemistry of our solar system by linking these special samples to their orbits. But the orbits are valuable for themselves, even if we don't find the meteorite. It really gives us an idea of the numbers. How many of these rocks are actually hitting Earth itself? And what is the basically impact rate of space rocks on Earth? So there was a really large event over Chelyabinsk, Russia in 2013. There was a 20-meter diameter asteroid that came through the atmosphere and exploded. And it exploded with the force of 500 kilotons of TNT. That's 30 times an atomic bomb. So although it's high up in the atmosphere, that shockwave came down and it smashed windows and it really hurt people. These sizes aren't really, they're definitely not civilization-ending events, and no one died, thank goodness. But people still got hurt, and there's about $30 million worth of damages. So although we've got these telescope surveys looking out into space, trying to figure out where all these hazardous near-Earth asteroids are, they've got a really good idea. About 98%, we reckon, of the kilometre-sized civilization-ending asteroids, we know where they are. We've got them tracked, no worries. But these 20-metre diameter ones are still quite dangerous to people and structures. And we reckon... less than 1% of where those bodies are in our solar system. So that Chelyabinsk event is estimated to be one every 50 years, but the uncertainty we have on that is it could be one every 15, or it could be one every 500. That's actually a huge uncertainty range in a human's lifetime. So what we're trying to do with the DFN is get a better idea of those orbits. Where are these things coming from in particular? Is there some area of space we should be pointing those telescopes to get a better idea of the hazard and where these things are coming from? So I guess that's just an overview of the big picture sciencey things that we're looking at with the Global Fireball Observatory. But we are observing the sky every night, and we see really cool astronomical events such as supernova and satellites, and we get to partner with some really awesome groups from defence. And I'm really excited that we're going to be trying to partner with the WA police to actually turn that drone searching idea back to search and rescue with them in the near future. So that's kind of what I do. But I do want to also encourage anyone to get involved with exploring the great unknown with us. Space is big, and the opportunities to get involved are basically as limitless as your imagination. I hear people say, oh yeah, but I'm not an engineer or a rocket scientist, but it is basically endless. There's things, space law, you could design a spacesuit, you could even design mission patches. There's basically a place for anyone at any stage of your career if you really are passionate about space. And you don't have to go to the USA to work for NASA to do it either. Here at Curtin University, we're launching our second mini satellite. We've got a whole mini satellite program, and we work with NASA and the European Space Agency. and JAXA and quite a few of us, myself included, are actually interplanetary mission scientists with NASA right here in WA, with some of the world's leading astronomical facilities like the MWA and the Fugro Sparks facility that's just opened here in downtown Perth, which is going to be mission control for missions to the moon very shortly. It won't be long until we're running our own planetary science missions from here in WA, so thank you very much.
You just heard from Dr. Eleanor Sansom, Program Manager of the Global Fireball Observatory. Ellie was speaking at our Occam's Razor live event at the WA Museum Boolabardib on the lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. And speaking of Occam's Razor live events, we have one coming up very soon in Brisbane. It's on the 24th of March and you can get your tickets via the ABC Occam's Razor website. I'm Tegan Taylor and I'll be back next week with more science rock stars.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.